23. I wish Bob Ewell wouldn't chew tobacco, was all Atticus said about it. According to Miss Stephanie Crawford, however, Atticus was leaving the post office when Mr. Ewell approached him, cursed him, spat on him, and threatened to kill him. Miss Stephanie, who by the time she had told it twice, was there and had seen it all, passing by from the jitney jungle she was. Miss Stephanie said Atticus didn't bat an eye, just took out his handkerchief and wiped his face, and stood there and let Mr. Ewell call him names wild horses could not bring her to repeat. Mr. Ewell was a veteran of an obscure war. That, plus Atticus's peaceful reaction, probably prompted him to inquire, "Too proud to fight, you nigger-loving bastard?" Miss Stephanie said Atticus said, "No, too old," put his hands in his pockets, and strolled on. Miss Stephanie said you had to hand it to Atticus Finch. He could be right dry sometimes. Jim and I didn't think it entertaining. "After all, though," I said, "he was the deadest shot in the county one time. He could, you know, he wouldn't carry a gun, Scout. He ain't even got one," said Jim. "You know, he didn't even have one down at the jail that night. He told me having a gun around's an invitation to somebody to shoot you." "This is different," I said. "We can ask him to borrow one." We did, and he said, "Nonsense." Dill was of the opinion that an appeal to Atticus's better nature might work. After all, we would starve if Mr. Ewell killed him, besides be raised exclusively by Aunt Alexandra, and we all knew the first thing she'd do before Atticus was under the ground good would be to fire Calpurnia. Jim said it might work if I cried and flung a fit, being young and a girl. That didn't work either. But when he noticed us dragging around the neighborhood, not eating, taking little interest in our normal pursuits, Atticus discovered how deeply frightened we were. He tempted Jim with a new football magazine one night. When he saw Jim flip the pages and toss it aside, he said, "What's bothering you, son?" Jim came to the point. "Mr. Ewell."
"What has happened?"
"Nothing's happened. We're scared for you, and we think you ought to do something about him." Atticus smiled wryly. "Do what? Put him under a peace bond?" "When a man says he's going to get you, looks like he means it."
"He meant it when he said it," said Atticus.
"Jim, see if you can stand in Bob Ewell's shoes a minute." I destroyed his last shred of credibility at that trial, if he had any to begin with. The man had to have some kind of comeback. His kind always does. So if spitting in my face and threatening me saved Maella Ewell one extra beating, that's something I'll gladly take. He had to take it out on somebody, and I'd rather it be me than that house full of children out there. You understand? Jim nodded. Aunt Alexandra entered the room as Atticus was saying, "We don't have anything to fear from Bob Ewell. He got it all out of his system that morning." "I wouldn't be so sure of that, Atticus," she said. "His kind of do anything to pay off a grudge. You know how those people are." "What on earth could Ewell do to me, sister?"
"Something furtive," Aunt Alexandra said. "You may count on that."
"Nobody has much chance to be furtive and make 'em," Atticus answered. After that, we were not afraid. Summer was melting away, and we made the most of it. Atticus assured us that nothing would happen to Tom Robinson until the higher court reviewed his case, and that Tom had a good chance of going free, or at least of having a new trial. He was at Enfield Prison Farm, 70 miles away in Chester County.
I asked Atticus if Tom's wife and children were allowed to visit him, but Atticus said no. If he loses his appeal, I asked one evening, what'll happen to him?
He'll go to the chair, said Atticus, unless the governor commutes his sentence.
Not time to worry yet, Scout. We've got a good chance.
Jim was sprawled on the sofa reading Popular Mechanics. He looked up.
It ain't right. He didn't kill anybody, even if he was guilty. He didn't take anybody's life.
You know rape's a capital offense in Alabama, said Atticus.
Yes, sir, but the jury didn't have to give him death. If they wanted to, they could have gave him 20 years.
Given, said Atticus. Tom Robinson's a colored man, Jim. No jury in this part of the world's going to say, we think you're guilty, but not very. On a charge like that, it was either a straight acquittal or nothing.
Jim was shaking his head. I know it's not right, but I can't figure out what's wrong. Maybe rape shouldn't be a capital offense.
Atticus dropped his newspaper beside his chair. He said he didn't have any quarrel with the rape statute, none whatever, but he did have deep misgivings when the state asked for and the jury gave a death penalty on purely circumstantial evidence. He glanced at me, saw I was listening, and made it easier. I mean, before a man is sentenced to death for murder, say, there should be one or two eyewitnesses. Someone should be able to say, yes, I was there and saw him pull the trigger. But lots of folks have been hanged on circumstantial evidence, said Jim.
I know, and lots of them probably deserved it, too.
But in the absence of eyewitnesses, there's always a doubt. Sometimes only the shadow of a doubt. The law says reasonable doubt, but I think a defendant's entitled to the shadow of a doubt. There's always the possibility, no matter how improbable, that he's innocent.
Then it all goes back to the jury, then. We ought to do away with juries.
Jim was adamant. Atticus tried hard not to smile, but couldn't help it.
You're rather hard on us, son. I think maybe there might be a better way.
Change the law. Change it so that only judges have the power of fixing the penalty in capital cases.
Then go up to Montgomery and change the law.
You'd be surprised how hard that'd be. I won't live to see the law changed, and if you live to see it, you'll be an old man.
This was not good enough for Jim. No, sir, they ought to do away with juries. He wasn't guilty in the first place, and they said he was.
If you had been on that jury, son, and 11 other boys like you, Tom would be a free man, said Atticus. So far, nothing in your life has interfered with your reasoning process. Those are 12 reasonable men in everyday life, Tom's jury. But you saw something come between them and reason. You saw the same thing that night in front of the jail. When that crew went away, they didn't go as reasonable men. They went because we were there. There's something in our world that makes men lose their heads. They couldn't be fair if they tried. In our courts, when it's a white man's word against a black man's, the white man always wins. They're ugly, but those are the facts of life.
Doesn't make it right, said Jim stolidly. He beat his fist softly on his knee.
You just can't convict a man on evidence like that. You can't.
You couldn't, but they could, and did. The older you grow, the more of it you'll see. The one place where a man ought to get a square deal is in a courtroom. Be he any color of the rainbow, but people have a way of carrying their resentments right into a jury box. As you grow older, you'll see white men cheat black men every day of your life. But let me tell you something, and don't you forget it. Whenever a white man does that to a black man, no matter who he is, how rich he is, or how fine a family he comes from, that white man is trash. Atticus was speaking so quietly, his last word crashed on our ears. I looked up, and his face was vehement. There's nothing more sickening to me than a low-grade white man who'll take advantage of a Negro's ignorance. Don't fool yourself. It's all adding up, and one of these days we're going to pay the bill for it. I hope it's not in you children's time. Jim was scratching his head. Suddenly his eyes widened. Atticus, he said, why don't people like us and Miss Maudie ever sit on juries? You never see anybody from Macomb on a jury. They all come from out in the woods. Atticus leaned back in his rocking chair. For some reason, he looked pleased with Jim. I was wondering when that would occur to you, he said. There are lots of reasons. For one thing, Miss Maudie can't serve on a jury because she's a woman. You mean women in Alabama can't? I was indignant. I do. I guess it's to protect our frail ladies from sordid cases like Tom's. Besides, Atticus grinned, I doubt if we'd ever get a complete case tried. The ladies would be interrupting to ask questions. Jim and I laughed. Miss Maudie on the jury would be impressive. I thought of old Mrs. DeBose in her wheelchair. Stop that rapping, John Taylor. I want to ask this man something. Perhaps our forefathers were wise. Atticus was saying, with people like us, that's our share of the bill. We generally get the juries we deserve. Our stout Macomb citizens aren't interested in the first place. In the second place, they're afraid. Then they're afraid. Why? Asked Jim. Well, what if, say, Mr. Link Dees had to decide the amount of damages to award? Say, Miss Maudie, when Miss Rachel ran over her with a car. Link wouldn't like the thought of losing either lady's business at his store, would he? So he tells Judge Taylor that he can't serve on the jury because he doesn't have anybody to keep store for him while he's gone. So Judge Taylor excuses him. Sometimes he excuses him wrathfully. What'd make him think either one of 'em would stop trading with him? I asked. Jim said, Miss Rachel would. Miss Maudie wouldn't. But a jury's vote's secret, Atticus. Our father chuckled. You've many more miles to go, son. A jury's vote's supposed to be secret. Serving on a jury forces a man to make up his mind and declare himself about something. Men don't like to do that. Sometimes it's unpleasant. Tom's jury show made up its mind in a hurry, Jim muttered. Atticus's fingers went to his watch pocket. No, it didn't, he said, more to himself than to us. That was the one thing that made me think, well, this may be the shadow of a beginning. That jury took a few hours. An inevitable verdict, maybe, but usually it takes them just a few minutes. This time, he broke off and looked at us. You might like to know that there was one fellow who took considerable wearing down. In the beginning, he was raring for an outright acquittal. Who? Jim was astonished. Atticus's eyes twinkled. It's not for me to say, but I'll tell you this much. He was one of your old Sarum friends. One of the Cunninghams? Jim yelped. One of... I didn't recognize any of them. You're joking. He looked at Atticus from the corners of his eyes. One of their connections. On a hunch, I didn't strike him. Just on a hunch. Could have, but I didn't. "Golly Moses," Jim said reverently. "One minute they're trying to kill him, and the next they're trying to turn him loose. I'll never understand those folks as long as I live."
Attica said you just had to know him. He said the Cunninghams hadn't taken anything from or off of anybody since they migrated to the New World. He said the other thing about them was, once you earned their respect, they were for you tooth and nail. Attica said he had a feeling, nothing more than a suspicion, that they left the jail that night with considerable respect for the Finches. Then, too, he said, it took a thunderbolt plus another Cunningham to make one of them change his mind. If we'd had two of that crowd, we'd have had a hung jury. Jim said slowly, "You mean you actually put on the jury a man who wanted to kill you the night before? How could you take such a risk, Atticus? How could you?" "When you analyze it, there was little risk. There's no difference between one man who's going to convict and another man who's going to convict, is there? There's a faint difference between a man who's going to convict and a man who's a little disturbed in his mind, isn't there?" He was the only uncertainty on the whole list. "What kin was that man to Mr. Walter Cunningham?" I asked. Atticus rose, stretched, and yawned. It was not even our bedtime, but we knew he wanted a chance to read his newspaper. He picked it up, folded it, and tapped my head. "Let's see now," he droned to himself. "I've got it. Double first cousin."
"How can that be?"
"Two sisters married two brothers. That's all I'll tell you. You figure it out." I tortured myself and decided that if I married Jim and Dill had a sister whom he married, our children would be double first cousins. "Geminity, Jim," I said when Atticus had gone. "They're funny folks. Did you hear that, Annie?" Aunt Alexandra was hooking a rug and not watching us, but she was listening. She sat in her chair with her work basket beside it, her rug spread across her lap. Why ladies hooked woolen rugs on boiling nights never became clear to me. "I heard it," she said. I remember the distant, disastrous occasion when I rushed to young Walter Cunningham's defense. Now I was glad I'd done it. Soon's school starts. I'm going to ask Walter home to dinner. I planned, having forgotten my private resolve to beat him up the next time I saw him. He could stay over sometimes after school, too. Atticus could drive him back to Old Sarum. Maybe he could spend the night with us sometime. Okay, Jim? "We'll see about that," Aunt Alexandra said, a declaration that with her was always a threat, never a promise. Surprised, I turned to her. "Why not, Auntie? They're good folks." She looked at me over her sewing glasses. "Jean Louise, there is no doubt in my mind that they're good folks, but they're not our kind of folks." Jim says, "She means they're yappy, Scout." "What's a yap?" "Aw, tacky. They like fiddling and things like that." "Well, I do, too." "Don't be silly, Jean Louise," said Aunt Alexandra. "The thing is, you can scrub Walter Cunningham till he shines. You can put him in shoes and a new suit, but he'll never be like Jim. Besides, there's a drinking streak in that family a mile wide. Finch women aren't interested in that sort of people." "Auntie," said Jim, "she ain't 9 yet." "She may as well learn it now." Aunt Alexandra had spoken. I was reminded vividly of the last time she had put her foot down. I never knew why. It was when I was absorbed with plans to visit Calpurnia's house. I was curious, interested. I wanted to be her company, to see how she lived, who her friends were. I might as well have wanted to see the other side of the moon. This time the tactics were different, but Aunt Alexandra's aim was the same. Perhaps this was why she had come to live with us, to help us choose our friends. I would hold her off as long as I could. If they're good folks, then why can't I be nice to Walter? I didn't say not to be nice to him. You should be friendly and polite to him. You should be gracious to everybody, dear. But you don't have to invite him home.
What if he was kin to us, Auntie?
The fact is that he is not kin to us. But if he were, my answer would be the same.
Auntie, Jim spoke up, Attica says you can choose your friends, but you sure can't choose your family. And they're still kin to you no matter whether you acknowledge them or not. And it makes you look right silly when you don't.
That's your father all over again, said Aunt Alexandra, and I still say that Jean Louise will not invite Walter Cunningham to this house. If he were her double first cousin once removed, he would still not be received in this house unless he comes to see Atticus on business. Now that is that.
She had said, indeed not. But this time she would give her reasons.
But I want to play with Walter, Annie. Why can't I?
She took off her glasses and stared at me. I'll tell you why, she said. Because he is trash. That's why you can't play with him. I'll not have you around him, picking up his habits and learning Lord knows what. You're enough of a problem to your father as it is. I don't know what I would have done, but Jim stopped me. He caught me by the shoulders, put his arm around me, and led me sobbing in fury to his bedroom. Atticus heard us and poked his head around the door.
"It's all right, sir," Jim said gruffly. "It's not anything."
Atticus went away.
"Have a chew, Scout."
Jim dug into his pocket and extracted a Tootsie Roll. It took a few minutes to work the candy into a comfortable wad inside my jaw. Jim was rearranging the objects on his dresser, his hair stuck up behind and down in front, and I wondered if it would ever look like a man's. Maybe if he shaved it off and started over, his hair would grow back neatly in place. His eyebrows were becoming heavier, and I noticed a new slimness about his body. He was growing taller. When he looked around, he must have thought I would start crying again, for he said, "Show you something if you won't tell anybody." I said, "What?" He unbuttoned his shirt, grinning shyly.
"Well, what?"
"Well, can't you see it?"
"Well, no."
"Well, it's hair."
"Where?"
"There. Right there."
He had been a comfort to me, so I said it looked lovely. But I didn't see anything.
"It's real nice, Jim."
"Under my arms, too," he said. "Going out for football next year. Scout, don't let Annie aggravate you."
It seemed only yesterday that he was telling me not to aggravate Auntie.
"You know she's not used to girls," said Jim. "Leastways, not girls like you. She's trying to make you a lady. Can't you take up sewing or something?"
"Hell no. She doesn't like me. That's all there is to it, and I don't care. It was her calling Walter Cunningham trash that got me going, Jim, not what she said about me being a problem to Atticus. We got that all straight one time. I asked him if I was a problem, and he said not much of one, at most one that he could always figure out, and not to worry my head a second about bothering him. No, it was Walter. That boy's not trash, Jim. He ain't like the Yules."
Jim kicked off his shoes and swung his feet to the bed. He propped himself against the pillow and switched on the reading light.
"You know something, Scout? I've got it all figured out now. I've thought about it a lot lately, and I've got it figured out. There's four kinds of folks in the world. There's the ordinary kind like us and the neighbors. There's the kind like the Cunninghams out in the woods. The kind like the Yules down at the dump,
and the Negroes. What about the Chinese and the Cajuns down yonder in Baldwin County? I mean in Macomb County. The thing about it is, our kind of folks don't like the Cunninghams. The Cunninghams don't like the Yules, and the Yules hate and despise the colored folks. I told Jim that if that was so, then why didn't Tom's jury, made up of folks like the Cunninghams, acquit Tom despite the Yules? Jim waved my question away as being infantile. You know, he said, I've seen Atticus pat his foot when there's fiddling on the radio, and he loves pot liquor better than any man I ever saw. Then that makes us like the Cunninghams, I said. I can't see why Annie... No, let me finish. It does, but we're still different somehow. Atticus said one time, the reason Annie's so hipped on the family is because all we've got's background and not a dime to our names. Well, Jim, I don't know. Atticus told me one time that most of this old family stuff's foolishness because everybody's family's just as old as everybody else's. I said, did that include the colored folks and Englishmen? And he said, yes. Background doesn't mean old family, said Jim. I think it's how long your family's been reading and writing. Scout, I've studied this real hard, and that's the only reason I can think of. Somewhere along when the Finches were in Egypt, one of them must have learned a hieroglyphic or two, and he taught his boy. Jim laughed. Imagine Annie being proud her great-granddaddy could read and write. Ladies pick funny things to be proud of. Well, I'm glad he could, or who'd have taught Atticus and them? And if Atticus couldn't read, you and me'd be in a fix. I don't think that's what background is, Jim. Well, then, how do you explain why the Cunninghams are different? Mr. Walter can hardly sign his name. I've seen him. We've just been reading and writing longer than they have. No, everybody's got to learn. Nobody's born knowing. That Walter's as smart as he can be. He just gets held back sometimes because he has to stay out and help his daddy. Nothing's wrong with him. Nah, Jim, I think there's just one kind of folks. Folks. Jim turned around and punched his pillow. When he settled back, his face was cloudy. He was going into one of his declines, and I grew wary. His brows came together. His mouth became a thin line. He was silent for a while. That's what I thought, too, he said at last, when I was your age. If there's just one kind of folks, why can't they get along with each other? If they're all alike, why do they go out of their way to despise each other? Scout, I think I'm beginning to understand something. I think I'm beginning to understand why Boo Radley stayed shut up in the house all this time. It's because he wants to stay inside.
24. Calpurnia wore her stiffest starched apron. She carried a tray of Charlotte. She backed up to the swinging door and pressed gently. I admired the ease and grace with which she handled heavy loads of dainty things. So did Aunt Alexandra, I guess, because she had let Calpurnia serve today. August was on the brink of September. Dill would be leaving for Meridian tomorrow. Today he was off with Jim at Barker's Eddy. Jim had discovered with angry amazement that nobody had ever bothered to teach Dill how to swim, a skill Jim considered necessary as walking. They had spent 2 afternoons at the creek. They said they were going in naked, and I couldn't come, so I divided the lonely hours between Calpurnia and Miss Maudie. Today, Aunt Alexandra and her missionary circle were fighting the good fight all over the house. From the kitchen, I heard Mrs. Grace Merriweather giving a report in the living room on the squalid lives of the Maroonas, it sounded like to me. They put the women out in huts when their time came, whatever that was. They had no sense of family. I knew that'd distress Auntie. They subjected children to terrible ordeals when they were 13. They were crawling with yaws and earworms. They chewed up and spat out the bark of a tree into a communal pot and then got drunk on it. Immediately thereafter, the ladies adjourned for refreshments. I didn't know whether to go into the dining room or stay out. Aunt Alexandra told me to join them for refreshments. It was not necessary that I attend the business part of the meeting. She said it bore me. I was wearing my pink Sunday dress, shoes, and a petticoat, and reflected that if I spilled anything, Calpurnia would have to wash my dress again for tomorrow. This had been a busy day for her. I decided to stay out. "Can I help you, Cal?" I asked, wishing to be of some service. Calpurnia paused in the doorway. "You be still as a mouse in that corner," she said, "and you can help me load up the trays when I come back." The gentle hum of ladies' voices grew louder as she opened the door. "Why, Alexandra, I never saw such Charlotte. Just lovely. I never can get my crust like this. Never can. Who'd have thought of little dewberry tarts? Calpurnia, who'd have thought it? Anybody tell you that the preacher's wife's—" "No. Well, she is, and that other one not walking yet." They became quiet, and I knew they had all been served. Calpurnia returned and put my mother's heavy silver pitcher on a tray. "This coffee pitcher's a curiosity," she murmured. "They don't make 'em these days. Can I carry it in?" "If you be careful and don't drop it. Set it down at the end of the table by Miss Alexandra, down there by the cups and things. She's going to pour." I tried pressing my behind against the door, as Calpurnia had done, but the door didn't budge. Grinning, she held it open for me. "Careful now, it's heavy. Don't look at it, and you won't spill it." My journey was successful. Aunt Alexandra smiled brilliantly. "Stay with us, Jean Louise," she said. This was a part of her campaign to teach me to be a lady. It was customary for every circle hostess to invite her neighbors in for refreshments, be they Baptists or Presbyterians, which accounted for the presence of Miss Rachel, sober as a judge, Miss Maudie, and Miss Stephanie Crawford. Rather nervous, I took a seat beside Miss Maudie and wondered why ladies put on their hats to go across the street. Ladies and bunches always filled me with vague apprehension and a firm desire to be elsewhere, but this feeling was what Aunt Alexandra called being spoiled. The ladies were cool and fragile pastel prints. Most of them were heavily powdered but unrouged. The only lipstick in the room was Tangy Natural. Cutex Natural sparkled on their fingernails, but some of the younger ladies wore rose. They smelled heavenly. I sat quietly, having conquered my hands by tightly gripping the arms of the chair, and waited for someone to speak to me. Miss Maudie's gold bridgework twinkled. "You're mighty dressed up, Miss Jean Louise," she said. "Where are your breeches today?" "Under my dress." I hadn't meant to be funny, but the ladies laughed. My cheeks grew hot as I realized my mistake, but Miss Maudie looked gravely down at me. She never laughed at me unless I meant to be funny. In the sudden silence that followed, Miss Stephanie Crawford called from across the room. "What you going to be when you grow up, Jean Louise? A lawyer?" "No'm, I hadn't thought about it," I answered, grateful that Miss Stephanie was kind enough to change the subject. Hurriedly, I began choosing my vocation. Nurse, aviator. "Well, why, shoot, I thought you wanted to be a lawyer. You've already commenced going to court." The ladies laughed again. "That's Stephanie's a card," somebody said. Miss Stephanie was encouraged to pursue the subject. "Don't you want to grow up to be a lawyer?" Miss Maudie's hand touched mine, and I answered mildly enough, "No'm, just a lady." Miss Stephanie eyed me suspiciously, decided that I meant no impertinence, and contented herself with, "Well, you won't get very far until you start wearing dresses more often." Miss Maudie's hand closed tightly on mine, and I said nothing. Its warmth was enough. Mrs. Grace Merriweather sat on my left, and I felt it would be polite to talk to her. Mr. Merriweather, a faithful Methodist under duress, apparently saw nothing personal in singing "Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound That Saved a Wretch Like Me." It was the general opinion of Makem, however, that Mrs. Merriweather had sobered him up and made a reasonably useful citizen of him. For certainly, Mrs. Merriweather was the most devout lady in Makem. I searched for a topic of interest to her. "What did you all study this afternoon?" I asked. "Oh, child, those poor marooners," she said, and was off. Few other questions would be necessary. Mrs. Merriweather's large brown eyes always filled with tears when she considered the oppressed. "Living in that jungle with nobody but J. Grimes Everett," she said. "Not a white person'll go near 'em but that saintly J. Grimes Everett." Mrs. Merriweather played her voice like an organ. Every word she said received its full measure. The poverty, the darkness, the immorality, nobody but J. Grimes Everett knows. "You know, when the church gave me that trip to the campgrounds, J. Grimes Everett said to me, 'Was he there, ma'am?' I thought, 'Home on leave,' J. Grimes Everett said to me. He said, 'Mrs. Merriweather, you have no conception, no conception of what we are fighting over there.' That's what he said to me." "Yes, ma'am." I said to him, "Mr. Everett," I said, "the ladies of the Makem, Alabama Methodist Episcopal Church South are behind you 100%. That's what I said to him. And you know, right then and there, I made a pledge in my heart. I said to myself, when I go home, I'm going to give a course on the marooners and bring J. Grimes Everett's message to Makem. And that's just what I'm doing." "Yes, ma'am." When Mrs. Merriweather shook her head, her black curls jiggled. "Jean Louise," she said, "you are a fortunate girl. You live in a Christian home with Christian folks in a Christian town. Out there in J. Grimes Everett's land, there's nothing but sin and squalor." "Yes, ma'am." "Sin and squalor. What was that, Gertrude?" Mrs. Merriweather turned on her chimes for the lady sitting beside her. "Oh, that. Well, I always say forgive and forget. Forgive and forget. Thing that church ought to do is help her lead a Christian life for those children from here on out. Some of the men ought to go out there and tell that preacher to encourage her."
"Excuse me, Mrs. Merriweather," I interrupted. "Are you all talking about Mayella Yule?"
"May... No, child. That darky's wife. Tom's wife. Tom
Robbins, ma'am."
Mrs. Merriweather turned back to her neighbor.
"There's one thing I truly believe, Gertrude," she continued, "but some people just don't see it my way. If we just let them know we forgive 'em, that we've forgotten it, then this whole thing'll blow over."
Mrs. Merriweather," I interrupted once more, "what'll blow over?"
Again she turned to me. Mrs. Merriweather was one of those childless adults who find it necessary to assume a different tone of voice when speaking to children. "Nothing, Jean Louise," she said in stately largo. "The cooks and field hands are just dissatisfied, but they're settling down now. They grumbled all next day after that trial." Mrs. Merriweather faced Mrs. Farrow. "Gertrude, I tell you there's nothing more distracting than a sulky darky. Their mouths go down to here. Just ruins your day to have one of 'em in the kitchen. You know what I said to my Sophie, Gertrude? I said, 'Sophie, I said, you simply are not being a Christian today. Jesus Christ never went around grumbling and complaining, and you know, it did her good. She took her eyes off that floor and said, 'No, Miss Merriweather, Jesus never went around grumbling.' I tell you, Gertrude, you never ought to let an opportunity go by to witness for the Lord." I was reminded of the ancient little organ in the chapel at Finch's Landing. When I was very small, and if I had been very good during the day, Atticus would let me pump its bellows while he picked out a tune with one finger. The last note would linger as long as there was air to sustain it. Mrs. Merriweather had run out of air, I judged, and was replenishing her supply while Mrs. Farrow composed herself to speak. Mrs. Farrow was a splendidly built woman with pale eyes and narrow feet. She had a fresh, permanent wave, and her hair was a mass of tight gray ringlets. She was the second most devout lady in Maycomb. She had a curious habit of prefacing everything she said with a soft, sibilant sound. "Grace," she said, "it's just like I was telling Brother Hudson the other day. Brother Hudson," I said, "looks like we're fighting a losing battle. A losing battle." I said, "It doesn't matter to him one bit. We can educate 'em till we're blue in the face. We can try till we drop to make Christians out of 'em. But there's no lady safe in her bed these nights." He said to me, "Mrs. Farrow, I don't know what we're coming to down here." I told him that was certainly a fact. Mrs. Merriweather nodded wisely. Her voice soared over the clink of coffee cups and the soft bovine sounds of the ladies munching their dainties. "Gertrude," she said, "I tell you there are some good but misguided people in this town. Good but misguided. Folks in this town who think they're doing right, I mean. Now far be it from me to say who. But some of 'em in this town thought they were doing the right thing a while back, but all they did was stir 'em up. That's all they did. Might have looked like the right thing to do at the time. I'm sure I don't know. I'm not read in that field, but sulky, dissatisfied. I tell you, if my Sophie'd kept it up another day, I'd have let her go. It's never entered that wool of hers that the only reason I keep her is because this depression's on, and she needs her dollar and a quarter every week she can get it." "His food doesn't stick going down, does it?" Miss Maudie said it. Two tight lines had appeared in the corners of her mouth. She had been sitting silently beside me, her coffee cup balanced on one knee. I had lost the thread of conversation long ago when they quit talking about Tom Robinson's wife and had contented myself with thinking of Finch's Landing and the river. Aunt Alexandra had got it backwards. The business part of the meeting was blood-curdling. The social hour was dreary. "Maudie, I'm sure I don't know what you mean," said Mrs. Merriweather. "I'm sure you do," Miss Maudie said shortly. She said no more. When Miss Maudie was angry, her brevity was icy. Something had made her deeply angry, and her gray eyes were as cold as her voice. Mrs. Merriweather reddened, glanced at me, and looked away. I could not see Mrs. Farrow. Aunt Alexandra got up from the table and swiftly passed more refreshments, neatly engaging Mrs. Merriweather and Mrs. Gates in brisk conversation. When she had them well on the road with Mrs. Perkins, Aunt Alexandra stepped back. She gave Miss Maudie a look of pure gratitude, and I wondered at the world of women. Miss Maudie and Aunt Alexandra had never been especially close, and here was Auntie silently thanking her for something. For what, I knew not. I was content to learn that Aunt Alexandra could be pierced sufficiently to feel gratitude for help given. There was no doubt about it. I must soon enter this world, where on its surface fragrant ladies rocked slowly, fanned gently, and drank cool water. But I was more at home in my father's world. People like Mr. Heck Tate did not trap you with innocent questions to make fun of you. Even Jim was not highly critical unless you said something stupid. Ladies seemed to live in faint horror of men, seemed unwilling to approve wholeheartedly of them. But I liked them. There was something about them, no matter how much they cussed and drank and gambled and chewed, no matter how undelectable they were, there was something about them that I instinctively liked. They weren't hypocrites, Mrs. Perkins, born hypocrites, Mrs. Merriweather was saying. At least we don't have that sin on our shoulders down here. People up there set 'em free, but you don't see 'em setting at the table with them. At least we don't have the deceit to say to 'em, yes, you're as good as we are, but stay away from us. Down here we just say, you live your way and we'll live ours. I think that woman, that Mrs. Roosevelt's, lost her mind. Just plain lost her mind coming down to Birmingham and trying to sit with them. If I was the mayor of Birmingham, I'd... Well, neither of us was the mayor of Birmingham, but I wished I was the governor of Alabama for one day. I'd let Tom Robinson go so quick, the Missionary Society wouldn't have time to catch its breath. Calpurnia was telling Miss Rachel's cook the other day how bad Tom was taking things, and she didn't stop talking when I came into the kitchen. She said there wasn't a thing Atticus could do to make being shut up easier for him. That the last thing he said to Atticus before they took him down to the prison camp was, "Goodbye, Mr. Finch. There ain't nothing you can do now, so there ain't no use trying." Calpurnia said Atticus told her that the day they took Tom to prison, he just gave up hope. She said Atticus tried to explain things to him, and that he must do his best not to lose hope, because Atticus was doing his best to get him free. Miss Rachel's cook asked Calpurnia, why didn't Atticus just say, yes, you'll go free, and leave it at that? Seemed like that'd be a big comfort to Tom. Calpurnia said, because you ain't familiar with the law. First thing you learn when you're in a law and family is that there ain't any definite answers to anything. Mr. Finch couldn't say something so when he doesn't know for sure it's so. The front door slammed, and I heard Atticus's footsteps in the hall. Automatically, I wondered what time it was. Not nearly time for him to be home, and on Missionary Society days he usually stayed downtown till black dark. He stopped in the doorway. His hat was in his hand, and his face was white. "Excuse me, ladies," he said. "Go right ahead with your meeting. Don't let me disturb you. Alexandra, could you come to the kitchen a minute? I want to borrow Calpurnia for a while." He didn't go through the dining room, but went down the back hallway and entered the kitchen from the rear door. Aunt Alexandra and I met him. The dining room door opened again, and Miss Maudie joined us. Calpurnia had half risen from her chair.
"Cal," Attica said, "I want you to go with me out to Helen Robinson's house."
"What's the matter?" Aunt Alexandra asked, alarmed by the look on my father's face.
"Tom's dead."
Aunt Alexandra put her hands to her mouth.
"They shot him," said Atticus. "He was running. It was during their exercise period. They said he just broke into a blind, raving charge at the fence and started climbing over, right in front of them."
"Didn't they try to stop him? Didn't they give him any warning?" Aunt Alexandra's voice shook.
"Oh, yes. The guards called to him to stop. They fired a few shots in the air, then to kill. They got him just as he went over the fence. They said if he'd had two good arms, he'd have made it. He was moving that fast. 17 bullet holes in him. They didn't have to shoot him that much. Cal, I want you to come out with me and help me tell Helen."
"Yes, sir," she murmured, fumbling at her apron. Miss Maudie went to Calpurnia and untied it.
"This is the last straw, Atticus," Aunt Alexandra said.
"Depends on how you look at it," he said. "What was one Negro, more or less, among 200 of them? He wasn't Tom to them. He was an escaping prisoner."
Atticus leaned against the refrigerator, pushed up his glasses, and rubbed his eyes. "We had such a good chance," he said. "I told him what I thought, but I couldn't in truth say that we had more than a good chance. I guess Tom was tired of white men's chances and preferred to take his own. Ready, Cal?"
"Yes, sir,
Mr. Finch." "Then let's go." Aunt Alexandra sat down in Calpurnia's chair and put her hands to her face. She sat quite still. She was so quiet, I wondered if she would faint. I heard Miss Maudie breathing as if she had just climbed the steps, and in the dining room the ladies chattered happily. I thought Aunt Alexandra was crying, but when she took her hands away from her face, she was not. She looked weary. She spoke, and her voice was flat. "I can't say I approve of everything he does, Maudie, but he's my brother, and I just want to know when this will ever end." Her voice rose. "It tears him to pieces. He doesn't show it much, but it tears him to pieces. I've seen him when...
What else do they want from him, Maudie? What else?"
"What does who want, Alexandra?" Miss Maudie asked. "I mean this town. They're perfectly willing to let him do what they're too afraid to do themselves. It might lose them a nickel. They're perfectly willing to let him wreck his health doing what they're afraid to do. They're..."
"Be quiet, they'll hear you," said Miss Maudie. "Have you ever thought of it this way, Alexandra? Whether Makem knows it or not, we're paying the highest tribute we can pay a man. We trust him to do right. It's that simple."
"Who?"
Aunt Alexandra never knew she was echoing her 12-year-old nephew. "The handful of people in this town who say that fair play is not marked white only. The handful of people who say a fair trial is for everybody, not just us. The handful of people with enough humility to think, when they look at a Negro, there but for the Lord's kindness am I." Miss Maudie's old crispness was returning. "The handful of people in this town with background. That's who they are."
Had I been attentive, I would have had another scrap to add to Jim's definition of background, but I found myself shaking and couldn't stop.
I had seen Enfield Prison Farm, and Atticus had pointed out the exercise yard to me. It was the size of a football field. "Stop that shaking," commanded Miss Maudie, and I stopped. "Get up, Alexandra. We've left 'em long enough." Aunt Alexandra rose and smoothed the various whalebone ridges along her hips. She took her handkerchief from her belt and wiped her nose. She patted her hair and said, "Do I show it?" "Not a sign," said Miss Maudie. "Are you together again, Jean Louise?" "Yes, ma'am." "Then let's join the ladies," she said grimly. Their voices swelled when Miss Maudie opened the door to the dining room. Aunt Alexandra was ahead of me, and I saw her head go up as she went through the door. "Oh, Mrs. Perkins," she said, "you need some more coffee. Let me get it." "Calpurnia's on an errand for a few minutes, Grace," said Miss Maudie. "Let me pass you some of these dewberry tarts. Do you hear what that cousin of mine did the other day, the one who likes to go fishing?" And so they went, down the row of laughing women, around the dining room, refilling coffee cups, dishing out goodies as though their only regret was the temporary domestic disaster of losing Calpurnia. The gentle hum began again. "Yes, sir, Mrs. Perkins, that J. Grimes Everett is a martyred saint. He needed to get married, so they ran to the beauty parlor every Saturday afternoon. Soon as the sun goes down, he goes to bed with the chickens, a crate full of sick chickens. Fred says that's what started it all. Fred says..." Aunt Alexandra looked across the room at me and smiled. She looked at a tray of cookies on the table and nodded at them. I carefully picked up the tray and watched myself walk to Mrs. Merriweather. With my very best company manners, I asked her if she would have some. After all, if Auntie could be a lady at a time like this, so could I. 25. "Don't do that, Scout. Set him out on the back steps." "Jim, are you crazy?" "I said set him out on the back steps." Sighing, I scooped up the small creature, placed him on the bottom step, and went back to my cot. September had come, but not a trace of cool weather with it, and we were still sleeping on the back screen porch. Lightning bugs were still about. The night crawlers and flying insects that beat against the screen the summer long had not gone wherever they go when autumn comes. A roly-poly had found his way inside the house. I reasoned that the tiny varmint had crawled up the steps and under the door. I was putting my book on the floor beside my cot when I saw him. The creatures are no more than an inch long, and when you touch them, they roll themselves into a tight gray ball. I lay on my stomach, reached down, and poked him. He rolled up. Then, feeling safe, I suppose, he slowly unrolled. He traveled a few inches on his hundred legs, and I touched him again. He rolled up. Feeling sleepy, I decided to end things. My hand was going down on him when Jim spoke. Jim was scowling. It was probably a part of the stage he was going through, and I wished he would hurry up and get through it. He was certainly never cruel to animals, but I had never known his charity to embrace the insect world. "Why couldn't I mash him?" I asked. "Because they don't bother you," Jim answered in the darkness. He had turned out his reading light. "Reckon you're at the stage now where you don't kill flies and mosquitoes now, I reckon," I said. "Let me know when you change your mind. Tell you one thing, though. I ain't going to sit around and not scratch a red bug." "Aw, dry up," he answered drowsily. Jim was the one who was getting more like a girl every day, not I. Comfortable, I lay on my back and waited for sleep,
and while waiting, I thought of Dill. He had left us the first of the month with firm assurances that he would return the minute school was out. He guessed his folks had got the general idea that he liked to spend his summers in Macomb. Miss Rachel took us with them in the taxi to Macomb Junction, and Dill waved to us from the train window until he was out of sight. He was not out of mind. I missed him. The last 2 days of his time with us, Jim had taught him to swim. Taught him to swim. I was wide awake, remembering what Dill had told me. Barker's Eddy is at the end of a dirt road off the Meridian Highway, about a mile from town. It is easy to catch a ride down the highway on a cotton wagon or from a passing motorist, and the short walk to the creek is easy. But the prospect of walking all the way back home at dusk, when the traffic is light, is tiresome, and swimmers are careful not to stay too late. According to Dill, he and Jim had just come to the highway when they saw Atticus driving toward them. He looked like he had not seen them, so they both waved. Atticus finally slowed down. When they caught up with him, he said, "You'd better catch a ride back. I won't be going home for a while." Calpurnia was in the back seat. Jim protested, then pleaded, and Atticus said, "All right, you can come with us if you stay in the car." On the way to Tom Robinson's, Atticus told them what had happened. They turned off the highway, rode slowly by the dump, and past the Ewell residence, down the narrow lane to the Negro cabins. Dill said a crowd of black children were playing marbles in Tom's front yard. Atticus parked the car and got out. Calpurnia followed him through the front gate. Dill heard him ask one of the children, "Where's your mother, Sam?" And heard Sam say, "She down at Sis Stevens, Mr. Finch. Want me run fetch her?" Dill said Atticus looked uncertain. Then he said yes, and Sam scampered off. "Go on with your game, boys," Atticus said to the children. A little girl came to the cabin door and stood looking at Atticus. Dill said her hair was a wad of tiny, stiff pigtails, each ending in a bright bow. She grinned from ear to ear and walked toward our father, but she was too small to navigate the steps. Dill said Atticus went to her, took off his hat, and offered her his finger. She grabbed it, and he eased her down the steps. Then he gave her to Calpurnia. Sam was trotting behind his mother when they came up. Dill said, Helen said, "Evening, Mr. Finch, won't you have a seat?" But she didn't say any more, neither did Atticus. "Scout," said Dill, "she just fell down in the dirt, just fell down in the dirt like a giant with a big foot just came along and stepped on her, just oomph." Dill's fat foot hit the ground like you'd step on an ant. Dill said Calpurnia and Atticus lifted Helen to her feet and half-carried, half-walked her to the cabin. They stayed inside a long time, and Atticus came out alone. When they drove back by the dump, some of the Ewells hollered at him, but Dill didn't catch what they said. Macomb was interested by the news of Tom's death for perhaps 2 days. 2 days was enough for the information to spread through the county. "Did you hear about?" "No. Well, they say he was running fit to beat lightning." To Macomb, Tom's death was typical. Typical of a nigger to cut and run. Typical of a nigger's mentality to have no plan, no thought for the future, just run blind first chance he saw. Funny thing, Atticus Finch might have got him off scot-free, but wait, hell no, you know how they are, easy come, easy go. Just shows you, that Robinson boy was legally married.
They say he kept himself clean, went to church and all that, but when it comes down to the line, the veneer's mighty thin. Nigger always comes out in them. A few more details, enabling the listener to repeat his version in turn, then nothing to talk about until the Macomb Tribune appeared the following Thursday. There was a brief obituary in the colored news, but there was also an editorial. Mr. B.B. Underwood was at his most bitter, and he couldn't have cared less who canceled advertising and subscriptions. But Macomb didn't play that way. Mr. Underwood could holler till he sweated and write whatever he wanted to. He'd still get his advertising and subscriptions. If he wanted to make a fool of himself and his paper, that was his business. Mr. Underwood didn't talk about miscarriages of justice. He was writing so children could understand. Mr. Underwood simply figured it was a sin to kill cripples, be they standing, sitting, or escaping. He likened Tom's death to the senseless slaughter of songbirds by hunters and children, and Macomb thought he was trying to write an editorial poetical enough to be reprinted in the Montgomery Advertiser. How could this be so, I wondered, as I read Mr. Underwood's editorial. Senseless killing. Tom had been given due process of law to the day of his death. He had been tried openly and convicted by 12 good men and true. My father had fought for him all the way. Then Mr. Underwood's meaning became clear. Atticus had used every tool available to free men to save Tom Robinson. But in the secret courts of men's hearts, Atticus had no case. Tom was a dead man the minute Mayella Yule opened her mouth and screamed. The name Yule gave me a queasy feeling. Macomb had lost no time in getting Mr. Yule's views on Tom's demise and passing them along through that English channel of gossip, Miss Stephanie Crawford. Miss Stephanie told Aunt Alexandra in Jim's presence, "Oh, Foot, he's old enough to listen," that Mr. Yule said it made one down and about two more to go. Jim told me not to be afraid. Mr. Yule was more hot gas than anything. Jim also told me that if I breathed a word to Atticus, if in any way I let Atticus know I knew, Jim would personally never speak to me again.